content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the March 21st, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Wood Sorrel House by Zach Williams. It was a modest summer rental, the kind Rana recalled from girlhood trips to Maine or Vermont or the Finger Lakes, set in a small clearing on a thickly wooded mountainside, peacefully out of sight of roads or neighbors or anything else. Jacob opened all the doors, came back downstairs, and remarked a little sternly that the cottage needed updates. The range wobbled, the mattress caved in the middle, the woolly plaid sofas were from another era. Still, there was something idyllic about the place. They unpacked into daisy-papered drawers and put their toothbrushes behind the spotted mirror. Max got his very own room. When he woke crying in the night, Rana walked down the hall and took him from the crib, a wooden antique with rattling bars. On the shelves in the den, molted antlers served as bookends. A high and lowest strip hung in a frame there. "I've been coming to this old cottage since I was a little girl," it read. "I love the smell of mothballs, the beat-up furniture, the rickety porch. There's no TV, telephone, or internet, but that is what I like best." That week, a hot front rolled up the mountain. They spent an afternoon in the forest by the stream. Wiry insects skated on the eddies near the banks. Woodpeckers sounded overhead. Rana repeated the word to teach it to Max. Woodpecker. He could say more and more and was newly walking. When he tripped over a root, she stood him up and brushed away the pine needles. In his fire truck shirt and blue summer shoes, he set off again, dragging Quinn, his cloth doll, by the leg. Climbing back to the house, they saw the snapping turtle for the first time. The light had deepened, but the day was still hot, teeming with flies and gnats. The turtle stopped to watch them from the grass beside the path. It was enormous. Pale mud streaked its shell. Its skin was gnarled. It might be 100 years old, Rana thought. They did live to ages like that. Staggering, cartoonish ages. Max turned his shoulders, pouting. "Too scary," he said. It was his one conceptual word. What he meant by it was hard to say. The turtle was scary, but so were spinach and nap time. Jacob said, "No, it's pretty, look," and he set Max down, squatted behind the turtle, curled his fingers under the shell on either side, and lifted it into the air. The turtle splayed its legs, twisted its neck, showed its tongue and teeth as if gasping. It must have nested nearby. The next time she saw it was weeks later, or months, if months was the right word. In those early years, or whatever they were, she grew strangely attached to the turtle. Nights, once Max was down, Rana and Jacob would play Risk, an old set, the boxes' split corners held with masking tape, and talk their way along the edges of the hard questions. For example, their car. Where was it? There wasn't even a driveway. Had someone dropped them off? From whom had they rented the cottage? For how long? How much time had passed before those questions occurred to them? How much more before the questions grew urgent? Jacob argued that the way to understand the situation was through numbers, facts, records, anything they could observe and set down, because that was the way you solved the puzzle. But Rana felt sure that the place didn't follow those rules. She tried to show him what she meant. For instance, his plan to track the moon's progress in his journal. It was, of course, a good idea. If the moon did behave oddly here, that might suggest further lines of inquiry, a chain of discoveries. But think of all the nights when he'd realized with a start that the moon was already up, that he'd forgotten the project altogether for who knew how long. He'd pull out all the drawers in search of the spiral notepad, which most of the time he couldn't find, despite looking behind the bookcase and in the cellar and below the kitchen sink and under the sofa where once, on his belly, an arm extended, he caught his fingers in a mousetrap. On the handful of nights when he did find the notepad, he'd run down the porch steps into the moonlight. He'd stay out for a long time, and then he'd come back all glum and drop it, still open to his earnest sketches, onto the floor. And, she added, a handful of nights. What if that's not right? What if it's dozens? Hundreds? Don't exaggerate, Jacob muttered, lying on the rug, his eyes hidden in the crook of his arm. It isn't hundreds. They were supposed to draw a line on the floral wallpaper for each new day, but they'd fight over who'd done it, or if anyone had, or whether it had been done twice. A small, impenetrable forest of ballpoint ink had sprung up there. Jacob's beard grew into his mouth. His hair ran past his shoulders. Rana would push it out of his eyes and offer to cut it, saying he looked uncomfortable. He'd tell her that comfort was a distraction. They had to stay focused. Her own hair she cut with the heavy scissors from the kitchen drawer, old-fashioned, black-handled, like the ones she remembered from school. She'd stand in front of the bathroom mirror, a towel around her shoulders. Max's hair somehow didn't seem to need cutting. In fact, it hadn't grown an inch. And his fingernails, could Jacob remember the last time they'd clipped Max's nails? No, he said, I don't know. Cut them then if they're long. And he went back down the steps to the cellar. He'd been obsessed by the chest freezer there. When and how and by whom was the food replenished? He was determined to sit unblinking in front of it until he got some answer. But, he admitted one night, amassing his forces, blue to threaten hers, green in Siam, I don't think. Somehow it doesn't. And his voice broke, his eyes welled up. I think maybe it isn't allowed. She crawled over the board and put her head on his shoulder. It was always summer on the mountain. Mornings, when Max's crying woke her, Rana would see how well he'd done by the hue of the light on the pines. She'd walk down the hall, softly past the spare room, which Jacob, with his insomnia, now used, and find Max waiting for her, holding the crib's bars. She'd pick him up, kiss the top of his head, smell his hair, take the pacifier from his mouth, and drop it into the jar on the dresser. Quinn, he'd sing as she carried him back to her bed. Every night they placed the doll on her nightstand, a little ceremony they had together. Good night, Quinn. Good night, Quinn. I'll see you in the morning. It was the only way he could bear to part with the thing. If she let him take it into the crib, he'd play with it for hours and never sleep. So, at sunrise, reunited, Max would pull Quinn tightly to his body and then push the doll away to appraise it. Rana spoke for Quinn, chirpily. Good morning, Max. Morning, he repeated. The doll's head slumped to one side. Did you have a good night's sleep? She watched the trees moving. Cool air bled through the screen. All the mornings fanned out together like reflections in facing mirrors. Max, looking at Quinn, would nod and say, Good sleep. For Jacob, the final memory was a pale white morning, sun in his eyes, and a downtown bus approaching. He thought he was coming from the gym. For Rana, it was scrubbing Max's back in their old blue tub. Around those moments, Jacob nursed little mythologies. Maybe he'd missed a sign flashing in the sunlight that morning, or there'd been some code meant for Rana in the galaxy of bubbles on Max's skin. On the floor of the den, legs crossed, eyes closed, Jacob would lead guided meditations, walking slowly down flight after flight of imaginary stairs, focused on breath, hands and feet tingling, trying to wrench the memories loose and uncover behind them something new, no matter how trivial, so long as it lay beyond the horizon of the sun in his eyes, or the soap. But he worried. What if, under scrutiny, their memories grew unstable, eroding, or degrading with the addition of confabulated parts? The final bridge to their old lives might crumble. What if the memory practice made things worse? About this problem, he could speculate endlessly. Occasionally, it terrified him. He'd run his hands over his head, staring into the distance as he spoke, and Rana would listen, feeding Max peas or bouncing him on her shoulders or lying with him, and Quinn on the carpet, playing trucks. Giving up the memory practice, Jacob moved on to enumeration, listing, between turns at risk, each reliable aspect of their new lives, no matter how trivial, hoping to piece together some rough cosmogony of the place. "Here," he began, "there is day." Rana, it was a stupid exercise, she hated it, would reply. "And night. Sun, moon, grass, trees, blue beetles, occasional rain, ferns that withdrew at the touch of a finger, the sign in the yard, wood sorrel house, and beyond that, the porch steps and the porch itself, the hall table and the high staircase, the cellar steps and all the dust-covered things at the bottom of them, the fishing pole and the wading coat, the crutches with the torn yellow padding, a tool chest, a sledgehammer, a gray tarp, a pile of red bricks, and a toy bucket and shovel that Max liked to use in the green plastic sandbox out back. Little Tykes brand, in the shape of a turtle. "What about the snapping turtle?" Rana offered once. The night was lush. Moths battered the screens. Jacob collected 6 blue armies. "The snapping turtle?" "Yeah. The last time she'd seen it was one morning near dawn, just after Max had begun to cry in his crib. No light yet on the pines. The turtle had lumbered over the grass, leaving a trail through the dew. It's the only one of its kind we've encountered. It's particular among the wildlife here. The birds and grasshoppers are indistinct. We often hear them without seeing them. They might be a kind of set design, a flourish. But the snapping turtle, it's got some kind of, I don't know how to put it, stature, doesn't it? Or character? It feels realer to me." She rolled the dice. "Say more." His tone was keen. She'd pleased him. She thought of the time she'd seen it with Max in the birch grove. "Scary," he'd whined again. But the turtle had watched them pass, really watched. "You can see a mind behind the eyes. It's so old, older than us. It's been here longer. Its experience of this place must run deeper. Too much experience, decades. It's almost cruel. What does it do here with so much time? I don't know. I've got questions about the snapping turtle. When I see it, I feel a sense of something larger. You're right, a wider world." She nodded, drew her breath to continue, then stopped. It was a delicate subject with Jacob, the one aspect of the place he wouldn't talk about. Max would slip and fall on the rocks or in the woods, and she'd race to him, turn him over, hoping to find his skin broken. It never was. Her skin had bronzed and cracked, new wrinkles ran from her eyes. But Max was the same. He never had learned woodpecker. In the notepad, she'd written down everything Max could say. Mama, Dada, Quinn, hat, outside, uh-oh, dirt, play, nose, waffles. She hadn't let herself work from memory. She'd waited until she heard each word anew. Light, bath, nap, scary. Soon, she had stopped needing to update the list. "Maybe," she said, "Max will live as long as the turtle." Jacob was silent. If she didn't look up at him, she would be able to keep talking. She stared into the wristboard's blue compass rose. "Or longer. I don't know how to think about it. I'm trying. Maybe he'll be here when the house collapses and the forest dies and the sun explodes." Her eyes were unfocused. Her throat had gone dry. "Isn't that an incredible thought?" "The snapping turtle," Jacob muttered. "You're right. Where does it go?" There were rows of old paperbacks on the shelves, spines laced with faults. They didn't appeal, but she'd read and reread them all, Gone with the Wind, The Pelican Brief, and A Case of Need. One day, Jacob thought to look up wood sorrel in the dog-eared Peterson Guide. Then he went out, found it growing all through the clearing and into the trees. It looked like clover, 3 heart-shaped leaflets joined at the stalk. Rana watched Jacob crane over the book. gray and haggard, a bunch of wood sorrel in his hand, and she thought suddenly of his vigils in the cellar, when they were still new here, his vow to solve the riddle of the chicken thighs and mixed berries in the freezer. He snapped the book shut and said, "It's edible, Ron. You can cook and eat this stuff." Much later, long after he'd left for good, she'd lie for hours in the wood sorrel, half dreaming that the lawn was absorbing her gently. One afternoon, she looked up the hill toward the house, run through with summer light, its doors and windows flung wide, to see Max crawling backward down the staircase inside. She was achy and spare, her sunburned scalp showed. He shouldn't do that, she thought, sitting up and shielding her eyes, but when, halfway down, he pushed off the stairs to stand, she laughed. A little mountain climber. There was even a comic aspect to the way he fell, straight back, arms wide, as in an old cartoon. The sound of his head hitting each step carried down the hill. When she opened her eyes, he'd come to rest on his back, stone still by the hall table. What if maybe he's dead, she thought, standing to cross the lawn. An unhurried breeze stirred the top of the pines. By the time she'd reached the porch, he was halfway up the stairs again on hands and knees. She sat down in the doorway, drifted off, and woke up in the dark. 2. The first time Jacob went exploring, he returned with rabbit skins, ragged and patched with gore, hanging from his bag. "I figure I'll get better at it," he apologized, letting them fall to the porch. That night, Rana put Max to bed by herself. Jacob was too exhausted. And then they talked on the couch in the den, he with his head across her lap. "I found a lake," he said. "You follow the stream down the mountain to where it levels, then on a little ways, and then it opens up all at once onto the water. I saw the sun glinting on the surface through the trees and thought I was dreaming, or dead. The water's cold and clear. There are fish in it." She whispered, "Fish?" It was somehow astounding. Jacob said he wanted to find the edge, if there was one. If it turned out that the wood sorrel house was in the real world, then the edge would be a road or a town. It would be the edge of their seclusion. If instead the place was something constructed, the edge might be more literal. Such a discovery would be horrifying. But then, at least, he would be able to map the interior. "I wonder," he said, "if it's automatically generated somehow. Maybe it's creating itself as I go. Like, I could walk for the rest of my life and it'd just be different configurations of the same trees, the same hills. But maybe not. Maybe if he walked far enough, he'd find a change in the pattern. Imagine if there were cities. They might be strange to us. The people in them might not be people exactly. There might be anything out there, enough to fill lifetimes." Rana ran her fingers through his hair. "I tried to stick Max with a sewing needle today. I wanted to see if I could hurt him, you know?" Feeling her voice shake, she bit her cheek. I was scared because what if I could? But I told myself that the way to take care of him sometimes is by hurting him, like an inoculation." Bent over his crib, she'd held the needle above the soft underside of his forearm. "But I kept dropping it," she said. "I couldn't do it. And if I didn't know if it was me or him or the place, and I really wanted to do it. I kept trying." Jacob lay with his eyes closed. "I climbed the high mountain." "Yeah?" She wiped her cheeks with her shirt sleeve. "I got above the tree line. I could see in every direction." She waited. "Nothing but trees. I could see the lake. I could see other mountains. A chain, but it's wilderness. It's all wilderness. Miles and miles. No roads. Nothing." "Could you see us?" she asked the house. Her mind ran over the day. Max atop her shoulders, leaning to pull a birch leaf from its stem, his outstretched arm before her. Jacob opened his eyes. "Who's accountable for this?" Absently, she pressed her thumb to his lips. He kissed it, and she pressed again, wanting him to open his mouth for her. She ran her left hand down his chest to his belt and began to pull at the buckle. He seized her wrist and flung it away. There was no alcohol in the house. There was, in the medicine cabinet, ibuprofen and antihistamines. She wondered if she could find something psychoactive in the woods, or poisonous. Though, if she wanted to die, there were better ways. Ceiling beams and rope, kitchen knives. She could slam her head against the wall, even, or drown herself in Jacob's Lake. His trips out grew longer. She'd stayed in bed, a pillow wrapped around her head to dampen the sound of Max's crying. She'd sweat and shiver talking to herself. But sooner or later, she'd have to get up, wash her face, drink from the faucet, brush her teeth, walk down the hall, turn the knob, open the door. He'd be there in the crib, diaper sodden, hair matted, eyes dark. She'd stand on the threshold. He'd grab the bars, pull himself up, raise both arms toward her. Once, Jacob stomped up the porch into the house and pulled Max from his high chair. A storm was coming. He wanted him to see it. Jacob was gaunt and sullen, his beard tied in two long braids. A weird green light fell over the clearing. Black clouds crossed the sky. Max squeezed the air between his fingers and whispered, "Too scary." And later, after they'd been without Jacob for a long time, it all happened again. Same stony clouds, same cold rain. "Too scary." She wished she could cut his head open and look inside. Had he retained any memory of the first time? Did Max hold on to scary things, or did they pass through him, the way the rain passed over the mountain? Once the blue sky had returned, the storm seemed impossible. When she asked Max if he remembered his father, he'd only point to something he recognized, a cup, a toy, a tree, and name it. On his final return to Wood Sorrel House, Jacob carried the snapping turtle impaled on a spear. Rana stood on the porch holding Max. "You killed it!" she called, horrified. He smirked. "Nasty effer tried to bite me." The spear, the serrated hunting knife he'd found in the cellar lashed to a broomstick, had sliced straight through the turtle's shell and out its padded chest. Upside down, legs splayed and tail limp, it shuddered each time the spear's butt struck the earth. Max watched as Jacob hung the turtle with a rope from a tree branch below the house and cleaned it. He worked efficiently. Its eyes were milky, its tongue swollen and foamed with spittle. The ancient skin fell in scraps, the meat was nearly purple. When Jacob had finished, the emptied shell swayed in the breeze. It had a spine, Rana thought in awe. Fried in butter, the meat was gristly and ripe. "Go on," Jacob urged. His teeth were filthy. Rana took a bite. She chewed until her throat contracted and saliva pooled, and then she spat into a napkin. Jacob slapped the table with both hands. "Max," he said, loud and grinning, "this country life does not agree with your poor old mother." 3. The lake was just as Jacob had described it. Glimpsing it through the trees, she wondered for a giddy instant if it held something stranger than water. But then she skirted it, moving under branches and through heavy brush until she found a rocky outcropping that spread down to the edge. It was perfect. She'd left before dawn, and now the midday sun baked the rock. She stretched out and fell asleep. No dreams. When she woke, she removed her clothes and stepped into the water. It was frigid. But afloat on her back, drifting out, she felt good. Near sunset, she took from her backpack a can of tuna, a sleeve of crackers, an apple, and a chocolate bar. She ate, and then went into the woods to gather branches and leaves and needles. She built a fire on the flat rock and spent the evening feeding it. She told herself scattered stories, watching the sparks on the water. She stayed 9 days. Near dawn on the 10th, she crashed up through the woods in a panic. It was still dark in the trees. She fell, rolled, and struck a rock. She couldn't breathe. She thought she'd broken a rib, even as the sky brightened, the space before her was hard to parse. Colors and shapes in the darkness, the woods all the same. She'd have to go back to the lake and start again. But she couldn't find the lake. The sun rose higher. She was thirsty. She wondered if this was what had happened to Jacob. And then she saw the water through the trees. She traced her way back to the outcropping where the embers of her fire still smoldered, and then out the way she knew she'd come. And when she found the stream, she followed it up the mountain. Max sat in the corner of his crib. The room was humid and dim. Everything he'd had, pacifier's blanket, the green water cup, he'd thrown onto the floor, except Quinn. He held the doll close. It was mangled and wet. He must have been gnawing at it. "Max," she said. Then she shouted it, grabbing his shoulders. And he said, "Too scary." Well, how had it been for the snapping turtle? It had slept in the high grass. In hot weather, it had sat in the stream. It had made its crooked way back and forth across the mountain. The turtle could not think. Presumably, it had been barely aware, but it had lived so long. And what sorts of understanding might be gained in 50 thoughtless years or 80 or 100? Couldn't the turtle have gathered some intelligence beyond itself? An intelligence in parallel or in secret? A remote space? If not in its brain, then somewhere else? A hidden compartment in which to hold the character of its experience? Bright nights and dark ones, soaking rains, the taste of chewed grass. What kinds of awareness might the turtle have accumulated in 150 years? What if it could have lived for 1,000? How long before it couldn't rightly be called a turtle? Her clothes hung loose, then fell apart. The words in the paperbacks grew blurrier until she could read them only if she bent close, with the shade off the lamp. New light bulbs were always in the closet by the stairs. Bars of soap, too, and extra sheets, talcum powder, needles, and thread. She'd mended Quinn so many times that it wasn't really Quinn anymore. The doll's face had worn away. Its clothes were gone. The only things that had changed in her life were dreams. So she paid more and more attention to them. She came to feel that all the dreams she'd ever had were connected, as if part of one vast landscape. And with practice, she could traverse it, discovering dreams she'd never remembered before. "I could drop him into the lake," she thought one morning, as she saw by the light on the pines that he'd woken too early. "But suppose he climbed out? I could try to do to him what Jacob did to the turtle. Eyes, tongue, brains, and bones all scattered. But I can't," she thought. "I can't. I can't." He sat holding Quinn, a pacifier in his mouth, in the crib. She fell down beside it, reached through the bars, and put her hand on his head. "Hi, Max," she said. She was shaking, covered in sweat. Did you have a good sleep?" Max took the pacifier from his mouth and said, "Sleep." 4. Something flew up the stairs toward her, struck her hands as she guarded her face. A blue jay had flown in through the open door. She twisted and fell down the steps, and then lay whimpering by the long hall table. Her ankle burned and was discolored. It wouldn't take any weight. She crawled into the den, pulled herself onto the couch, and shivered under the quilt, listening to the bird flit against the rafters. Upstairs, Max woke from his nap and began to cry. In the morning, she lowered herself down the cellar steps, seated, her left leg outstretched. The crutches stood in the corner. And then she found the backpack, filled it with food, took a lighter and a knife and the wading coat from its hook. The steps were too steep to climb, so she went out the storm doors into the clearing. She stood looking up at Max's window. Clouds stung her eyes. She rested that day and the next by the stream, and then she set off down the mountain on one crutch in little hops, her left hand tacky from saplings and branches. At the lake, she slept through a run of days, sun on her face, and at night she watched fish break the water's surface. Mornings, when it was cool, she gathered stones from the shoreline, piling the flattest and heaviest into cairns. How deep was the lake? Was it possible she'd sink past the edge into some other world? Yes, that was possible. There was just no help for it, any of it. It wasn't as if she could leave him a note or one last meal to eat or teach him to dress himself or use the toilet. The problem was too big. She had no power over it. She unbuilt the cairns, stone by stone, pushing each one into the pockets of the waiting coat. But more days passed, and slowly her mind started to change. Because here's what she could have done. She could have taken him out of the crib. As things stood, it was only if the legs rotted and it crashed to the floor, or the house burned down, or blew over, or fell apart, that he'd ever be free from it. 100 years? 1,000? Longer? She didn't know, however this thing worked. She went into the brush for more wood. Night came, and she stared into the fire. For the sake of argument, say she went back. She'd take him out of the crib and put him on the floor. Then what? She'd have to turn and run. He'd try to follow. Impossible. She couldn't. And in the crib, at least, he'd be safe. But from what? She threw twigs into the flames. Well, safe from scary things, because left alone, Max would fall down the stairs again. He might tumble down the mountain, crash through branches and over rocks. One scary thing after another, on and on into infinity. A kind of hell. What if somehow he followed her into the lake and a current swept him to the bottom and pinned him against her as she rotted? It was possible. She had to concede that. In the crib, nothing would happen, nothing at all, and that could be holy in a way. He'd be like a monk almost, a sort of saint, enshrined, enthroned, inhabiting eternity. She surprised herself by crashing into the water, not in some solemn moment after a speech or a prayer, but on impulse. Exhilarated by the cold, she kicked until her toes hit nothing, the stones pulling her, water throbbing in her ears. There was a hum or a hiss she could hear only once she'd gone under, an aquatic vibration, and then a shock at realizing that this was going to work. But she must have fought, despite herself. It was hard to remember. She found herself back on the outcropping, belly down, legs still in the water. All the way home to the cottage, she felt calm and strange, separated from things by a layer of noise. Max lay asleep in the crib. She kissed his brow. He stirred to life. She rocked him, seated on the edge of the toilet as a hot bath ran. She washed him clean while he sang to Quinn, and his wet skin glowed. He asked her to give Quinn a kiss, and she did it. Then she touched Max's nose, held his body, felt it swell with breath. She fell into the tub and dug at him with her fingers, pressed her face into his neck, gasping to take in the smell of his head. 5. She fixed him to her back in a swaddle of cut bed sheets and wore the backpack on her front. Quinn, she stuffed down beside him. The straps chafed, and Max squirmed and kicked, and sometimes he cried, but mostly as they traveled, he spoke softly to the doll. In the afternoon, they passed the lake. A victory. Of course, there was only more forest, all the same. She built a fire beneath an overhanging rock. She ate jerky and apologized to Max for not feeding him. He pouted, but then wandered off, picking up sticks and digging with them in the earth. The sun set. They sang to Quinn. I'll see you in the morning. In the night, she woke and felt Max breathing against her. They followed the sun, so she called it west. Sometimes the hills they climbed would level and drop limply back down. Other times, they'd break through the tree line to bare, rocky stretches where eagles skimmed overhead. They traveled along a mountain ridge, 2 beautiful days, but had to double back when they came to a high chasm, no way down. That afternoon, they saw black bears, 3 of them, nosing along the mountainside. She shifted Max so that he could see and said, bears. She stewed and ate nettles. She kicked mushrooms from tree trunks and roasted them. When Max put both hands into the fire, she panicked and started to shout, then stopped and let him. The trees thinned. No more big pines, only firs, growing shorter and sparser until It happened so gradually she barely noticed it. They were out of the forest. The soil turned sandy and pale. Before them was nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Now and then she'd look back, the forest edge like a wall and the mountains looming over it, clouds and sky above the peaks, all together like something in a fishbowl. She walked until it was only a green-blue smear, and then nothing. And then they were nowhere. On her back, Max was quiet and still. The sand was soft and felt nice on her feet. It faded to a dirty white, like smudged paper, and so did the horizon. When the lack of perspective made her dizzy, she walked with her eyes shut. They had no fires. She ran out of water. Sometimes Max whispered things in her ear. Then the last trace of gray was gone from the sand. It was fine and synthetic feeling. When displaced, it whirled into the air with unnatural lightness. The sky darkened, and the air grew thinner. It tasted like plastic. Then the only light was behind her, as if she were walking into a cave. And soon they were in total darkness. Okay, she thought, what now? She sat down, slipped the backpack straps over her arms, and found the lighter. Briefly, it lit the space around them. She pulled Max from her back, curled up with him, and fell asleep. When she woke, he was gone. She felt for the lighter and couldn't find it. The darkness jumped before her eyes, but then she calmed herself. He couldn't have gone far. She angled her head to listen, in one direction, then another, and on hands and knees she found the place where the sand went smooth again. In rigid, deliberate movements, she crawled out, feeling with her fingers, counting each motion away from the backpack and then returning. Wider each time, a spiral. Finally, she felt a divot in the sand ahead of her and then another, and she followed the indentations out, slow and careful, the blood loud in her ears. Her fingertips found Max's cloth diaper, and then his back, his shoulders, the nape of his neck. She went into a crouch and drew her arms around him. Only later did it terrify her. He'd been sitting perfectly still, staring into the dark. Back out in the light, it was the first thing she noticed. Max, where's Quinn? She dug through the pack. Quinn, he said. She looked toward the dark, then at him, and fell into wild sobs. 6. First, she knocked out the walls with the sledgehammer from the cellar. Then she dismantled the rooms upstairs from the inside out, chopped up the plaid sofas, the crib, the bookshelves, and the staircase board by board. No more stairs, only ramps, built from repurposed wood. The house was transformed into something like a dais with a wide, flat surface. She doesn't feed him. She leaves him for days in the woods. She has a cage and a rope, like a crab trap, and she leads him to the lake and submerges him inside it. Too scary, he says, once he's coughed up all the water. She shakes his face and tells him that it's not. One day, she imagines, I'll unlatch the top and pull him out, cold water pouring from the bottom, and he'll say nothing at all. He'll be quiet and strong. He'll have kept something from before. She believes this not only because she has to, but because he started talking about Quinn. He looks out over the treetops and tells her Quinn is in the dark. In his head must be a picture of the scene, a story he tells himself. And so it stands to reason that he may in some way remember what he's been taught. Maybe he'll remember her. There's a place in the yard where she buries her teeth when they fall out. 6 little funerals so far. She brings him to watch. Maybe she'll feel it coming and know to slink away. But even if she dies there on the ground, the time before she's gone to soil will be to him like nothing. She'll eat less and less, lie on her mat, boil wood sorrel with salt, He'll walk up the ramps, sleep in the grass, play in the bleached old turtle shell. The sun will rise early and set late. There will be beautiful days. And now, from the Onward and Upward with the Arts Department of the February 7th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the radical woman behind Goodnight Moon, Margaret Wise Brown, constantly pushed boundaries in her life and in her art, by Anna Holmes. Bruce Handy, in his 2017 book about children's literature, Wild Things, confesses that he always imagined the writer Margaret Wise Brown to be a dowdy old lady, quote, with an ample lap, end quote, just like the matronly bunny from her classic story, Goodnight Moon, who whispers hush as evening darkens a great green room. In fact, Brown was a seductive iconoclast with a Katharine Hepburn mane and a compulsion for ignoring the rules. Anointed by Life in 1946 as the, quote, world's most prolific picture book writer, end quote, she burned through her money as quickly as she earned it, traveling to Europe on ocean liners and spending entire advances on Chrysler convertibles. Her friends called her mercurial and mystical. Though many of her picture books were populated with cute animals, she wore wolfskin jackets, had a fetish for fur, and hunted rabbits on weekends. Her romances were volatile. She was engaged to two men, but never married, and she had a decade-long affair with a woman. At the age of 42, she died suddenly in the south of France after a clot cut off the blood supply to her brain. Many readers now think of Brown titles like The Runaway Bunny as tranquil introductions to storytelling, but they were radical for their time. When Brown was emerging as a writer in the 1930s, most books for young children drew on classic fables and folktales, providing moral instruction on each page. She rejected this orthodoxy in favor of stories that better reflected the preoccupations of young children, from sensual pleasures, the shape of an apple, to visceral emotions, fear of the dark. Brown argued that when boys and girls are first exposed to reading, they are most engaged by stories about tables and chairs, plates and telephones, animals they know. Even though her work embraced everyday subjects, it was far from banal. Brown incorporated influences from avant-garde literature, concentrating as much on the sound of words as on the words themselves. And she often commissioned illustrations from modernist painters who understood the allure of bold color. Brown helped create a new type of children's literature that provided both oral and visual feasts. Her books, including Goodnight Moon, which celebrates its 75th anniversary this year, delighted, surprised, and sometimes disturbed. Brown was born in Brooklyn in 1910, the second of three children. Her mother, Maud, was a homemaker who had dreamed of becoming an actress, according to Amy Gary, the author of a 2017 biography, In the Great Green Room, The Brilliant and Bold Life of Margaret Wise Brown. Maud was prone to bouts of depression, sometimes refusing to leave her room. Brown's father, Robert, was an executive at a company that manufactured twine. For most of her childhood, the family lived in a spacious house on Long Island, where she kept busy by chasing butterflies, reading Andrew Lang's rainbow fairy tale collections, and hitching up all the dogs I could find to pull me around on my sled in the snow, she said. Brown's brashness and tendency toward extremes were evident from a young age. She was a tomboy with a terrible temper. Gary writes that when Brown became angry, she sometimes held her breath until she turned blue, prompting a nanny to plunge her head into a tub of ice-cold water. Such dunkings, Gary notes, had no lasting effect on Margaret's innate stubborn streak. She and her sister, Roberta, engaged in a bedtime ritual of greeting the objects and the sounds around them and then bidding them good night. Brown had few friends her age, counting among her closest companions a cat, a collie, two squirrels, and dozens of rabbits. After one of the rabbits died, Brown skinned it. According to Roberta, her sister had once joked about becoming a lady butcher. Brown's career began in New York in 1935 when she entered a teacher training program at Bank Street, an experimental school of education then situated in Greenwich Village. She had been casting about since graduating from Hollins College, taking writing and painting courses and unsuccessfully submitting short fiction to The New Yorker. She told a former teacher she felt like a bunch of peas that weren't cooked yet, quote, but are doing a lot of whirling about in the kettle, end quote. Bank Street was run by the formidable scholar Lucy Sprague Mitchell, who hoped to redefine early education by incorporating insights from the social sciences and from research into the lives of children. As Mitchell put it, she aimed to help aspiring teachers develop a scientific attitude and express the attitude of the artist towards their work and towards life. Brown was not cut out to be a teacher. Evaluations of her work from 1936 reported that, though she showed a fascination with individual children, she appeared blind to group dynamics and struggled to stay focused when leading a classroom. One instructor observed that Brown seemed fixated on words and language, as if she were more of a poet than a teacher. Another noted, much of the time Miss Brown seems to be in a daydream. Brown, however, was drawn to Mitchell's aggressive critique of traditional storytelling. Mitchell had published a controversial manifesto in the Here and Now storybook, arguing that children need stories anchored in the familiar before they can contend with fantasy or the unknown. Mitchell wrote, "It is only the blind eye of the adult that finds the familiar uninteresting. The attempt to amuse children by presenting them with the strange, the bizarre, the unreal is the unhappy result of this adult blindness." She went on, "Children do not find the unusual piquant until they are firmly acquainted with the usual. They do not find the preposterous humorous until they have intimate knowledge of ordinary behavior." Mitchell insisted that a young child doesn't really care about plot. When listening to a story, his enjoyment comes not from any awareness of a beginning and a middle and an end, but from the pleasure he gets in the action itself. This insight may help explain the appeal of the so-called here and now approach for Brown, whose writing instructors had criticized her for failing to create narrative arcs or to convey human emotion. Brown was most taken by the idea of writing for five-year-olds. "At five, we reach a point not to be achieved again," she once wrote in a notebook. In a paper on the topic, she argued that a child of that age enjoys a keenness and awareness that will likely be subdued out of him later in life. She went on, "Here, perhaps, is the stage of rhyme and reason, big as the whole world, deep as a giant, quiet as electricity rushing about the world, quiet as mud. All these are five-year-old similes. Let the grown-up writer for children equal or better them if he can." At the same time that Mitchell's ideas inspired Brown, they offended one of the most powerful figures in American children's literature, Anne Carroll Moore, the head of the children's division at the New York Public Library. Moore, who believed in starting children off with Hans Christian Andersen and Beatrix Potter, was suspicious of the social sciences, and, like some of her fellow librarians, she doubted whether meaningful children's literature could be engineered through the empirical study of children. As Leonard S. Marcus records in his deeply reported 1992 biography, Margaret Wise Brown Awakened by the Moon, the two camps engaged in a decades-long standoff, often called the fairy tale war. Moore believed that traditional myths and legends connected children with higher truths, and considered stories without morals to be a waste of time. Marcus notes that the library's internal review of Goodnight Moon deemed it unbearably sentimental. The book didn't appear on the shelves of city libraries until 1972, 11 years after Moore's death and 20 years after Brown's. Brown tested the limits of the here and now approach. One of her first published stories was inspired by the summer day during her childhood when she and two other girls discovered a dead bird. They took it into the woods and dug a grave, swaddled the bird in leaves, read a passage from the Bible, and sang a mournful song. They said that they hoped to come back every day with a clutch of fresh flowers. They didn't. The story begins, The bird was dead when the children found it. But it had not been dead for long. It was still warm. Some of Brown's associates reported feeling a general revulsion while reading the story. Even at Progressive Bank Street, which offered courses in Freudian theory, depictions of death and sex in children's literature were controversial. Brown once observed that Gertrude Stein shared with little kids an accidental playfulness with words. This feeling was a fundament of poetry. Children learning to speak, Brown later explained on a radio program, sort of half-chant their ideas. And she continued, if they like the sound of the words at all, they repeat them and make a pattern of them. Powerful picture book writing, she said, depended on writing words that will be heard. This sensual enjoyment of language was evident in Bumblebugs and Elephants, one of the first titles that Brown wrote and published for W.R. Scott. It employed a conceit that she returned to repeatedly, the juxtaposition of large and small. With a clever nod to a certain famous English fairy tale, there were three little pigs and a great big pig. In 1939, Brown wrote and published The Noisy Book, the story of a temporarily blind young dog, Muffin, who must rely on his hearing as he makes his way through the world with bandaged eyes. Brown did not heed the concerns of a staff psychologist at Bank Street, who expressed trepidation that the bandaged eyes evoked castration. Brown was ecstatic when Gertrude Stein herself agreed to write a picture book, The World is Round, for her imprint. The book is striking in part because of its lack of punctuation. Critics have noted the influence of Steinian wordplay on several Brown works, including the important book Four Fur Feet and Red Light, Green Light, which features repeated variations on the sentences Red Light, they can't go, Green Light, they can. Barbara Bader, a historian of children's literature, has described Goodnight Moon as abstract in form and concrete in substance, and its prose as closest to Gertrude Stein and to the utterances of children. Brown's most aesthetically provocative book was also one of her most adorable. In 1946, she published Little Fur Family in collaboration with Garth Williams, who later illustrated E.B. White's Charlotte's Web. For the first edition of Little Fur Family, which had a print run of 75,000 copies, Brown insisted that the book's cover be wrapped entirely in the fur of New Zealand rabbits. The result prompted one child to try to feed his dinner to his copy of the book, and another to offer her copy to a pet kitten as a companion. The book, like the leopard and zebra skin sofas that Brown bought to decorate her New York apartments, was mischievous, erotic, and a little sinister. In 1947, Brown published what is now her most famous book, Goodnight Moon. The action in this spare, poetic story about a bunny at bedtime is slow-moving, and the scene never really changes. As the young rabbit tosses and turns in a green-walled bedroom, saying goodnight to various things in the room, a mouse, a comb, a red balloon, Clement Hurd's illustrations in deep jewel tones slowly dim, panel by panel, and a soft scrim of stars outside the window begins to brighten. Through the years, Goodnight Moon has been imitated dozens of times. Picture books aimed at helping children fall asleep are so common that they have spawned parodies, including the 2011 bestseller Go the F to Sleep. But none of these books come close to achieving the surreal quality of Goodnight Moon, which marries elements of the here and now movement with the feeling of a hallucinatory reverie. The book combines the virtues of her best work, inspired nonsense, goodnight mush, repetitive language, enveloping visuals. Marcus, in his biography of Brown, describes the book as a cunning transparency of Bank Street ideas and their opposites. In time, it became a breakout commercial success. It has now sold more than 40 million copies. Goodnight Moon, like many modernist works of art, is full of tantalizing ambiguities. Is the book's wishing everything and everyone goodnight? Goodnight, nobody? Goodnight, comb? A meditation or an incantation? And who exactly is doing the wishing? Why is the dollhouse illuminated? Some of the strangest, most discomforting aspects of the book are the panels in which an adult bunny sits quietly in a rocking chair on the far side of the room, knitting and observing the shadowy flickerings going on. Like a ghost, she's sometimes there and sometimes not. One of the few living people who knew Brown well is James Stillman Rockefeller, Jr., her fiancé at the time of her death. Rockefeller was not with Brown in France when she died. She was on a solo vacation and developed the blood clot soon after having emergency surgery in Nice for what was either an ovarian cyst or an inflamed appendix. 2 weeks later, on November 13, 1952, she was preparing to be discharged. She was to leave the hospital and be carried in a sedan chair by four of the village boys to the hilltop estate of a friend, Chateau Barlow, where she would continue her convalescence. When Brown, in a puckish effort to demonstrate her good health to the medical staff, kicked up her leg can-can style, she dislodged a blood clot, blacked out, and died. A few dozen yards away from Brown's house in Vinyl Haven, Rockefeller erected a headstone for her. The inscription was composed by Brown herself, Margaret Wise Brown, writer of songs and nonsense. Obituaries were brief. The Times noted that she was one of the most prolific writers of stories for the very young, but made no serious claims about her literary merit. During the next decade, people who knew Brown began to contend that she was much more than a commercial success. In 1958, the influential children's book editor and critic Louise Seaman Bechtel published a 14-page appreciation of Brown in the journal The Horn Book, describing her as more poet than storyteller and declaring her the laureate of the nursery. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. You'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or printing impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.